Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzschrauber. On today's show, online sales tax. Brick and mortar retailers have long griped that online retailers are dodging taxes. And Congress and many states have proposed policies to try to fix this. But in their efforts to make things more fair, well, they end up actually discriminating against e-commerce and the internet. Joining me to discuss this is Steve Del Bianco, Executive Director of NetChoice, a trade association of e-commerce businesses and online consumers. Steve, thanks for joining the show.
Great to be here, Evan, and I'm grateful that you guys are tackling such a thorny issue.
Right? Yes, that's why we do this podcast, because it's easier to explain things in sometimes 20 to 30 minutes than 30 seconds, which is what a television talk show will give you. But consumers, you know, who are listening to this show might be thinking, yeah, sometimes when I buy things on Amazon, there's a sales tax. Sometimes there is not. And that might not be the reason I choose to buy something, but you might be scratching your head just like, I don't get it. Why is it sometimes and why not? So there's obviously a lot of bills and lawsuits floating around, but what's the current state of play? When do you get taxed? When do you not get taxed?
Right. This really has nothing to do with late breaking laws or lawsuits. It turns out that Amazon has increased its physical footprint across the United States to where they set up distribution centers. This enables them to do next day delivery and increases their ability to serve their customers. But when they do it, when they set up a fulfillment center in the state of, say, Virginia, then they have to collect sales tax on sales they make into Virginia because they have a physical presence. And that echoes back to 150 years of U.S. law, federal doctrine, that say that where you establish a physical presence, you have to collect sales tax when you make sales to residents of that state. And today, Amazon collects for about 98% of the U.S. population who pays sales tax. And they've done it voluntarily because they set up distribution centers in those states and created a physical presence by which they have to collect sales tax under ancient law. Not anything that's new at all.
Yeah, and it's important to point out that this controversy about out-of-state sales and taxing is not necessarily coming from the internet. You've had telephone sales, you've had mail order catalogs, and it poses the same question of if I get something in the mail from a company in New Jersey and I'm in New York, when I buy it, am I paying New Jersey sales tax? Am I paying New York sales tax or neither? So this has always been an issue. And there are some states that don't even collect sales tax, right? So how does that play into this?
That's right. We do have five states that don't have a sales tax on a statewide basis. And that means that residents of those states don't pay a sales tax when they buy from in-state. And when residents of those states buy from out-of-state retailers, there should be no sales tax either.
So the current law of the land comes from a 1992 decision, getting back to this idea that this is not necessarily a controversy that is born with the internet. But what did the Supreme Court say in Quill Corporation versus North Dakota, the decision that currently governs the internet sales tax landscape?
It's the 1992 decision, and Quill was a catalog company, Evan, and they were mailing catalogs all over the country, and one of the states they mailed them to was North Dakota. North Dakota decided to assess Quill for sales tax on sales they made to North Dakota residents, and that case made its all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And in 1992, no surprise here, the court reaffirmed where it had been 30 years earlier with an earlier catalog company in the Bellis Hess case. They reaffirmed that a state can only impose its sales tax obligations on sellers that have a physical presence in that state. So Quill wasn't new, Evan. Quill reaffirmed 150 years worth of doctrine, all of which echoes back to something that was in the U.S. Constitution 225 years ago. It's Article 1, the Commerce Clause, which says the Congress, not the states, can regulate tariffs and duties on interstate commerce. And that was put there by the Founding Fathers, whose experience showed them that the 13 original colonies were notorious for setting up tariffs and trade barriers to favor their own businesses over neighboring colonies. So Article 1 of our founding documents set the stage for this notion of protecting interstate commerce from the vagaries, from the discrimination, from the tax burdens that individual states would probably impose if they were not prohibited from doing so.
So getting to what is the gripe here. So brick and mortar retailers, obviously, they have a complaint here. And we wouldn't be debating this and talking about this on the show if everyone agreed that Quill was wonderful and that should stay. So you just got a practical issue here, right? If I am a New Yorker and I buy something from a company in another state and I'm not getting taxed, does that put the stores in my state at a disadvantage to online retailers, right? That's the complaint we hear from brick and mortar stores, is that they're put at a disadvantage because people can buy stuff with no sales tax on the internet if they manage to buy it from a company that doesn't have a physical presence in their state. Is this a legitimate gripe by the brick and mortar retailers, and should we do something about it?
Yeah, you explained it very well, Evan. And your explanation would have held true 70 years ago when the catalogs were causing the same kind of a concern for retailers. There were catalog bonfire parties in parts of Chicago, as I recall.
Sounds like fun.
In 1950, seriously. And the gripe, legitimate gripe, as I think is how you said it, is that any retailer who finds himself facing competition from others who charge less, who may have lower prices for a variety of reasons, or aren't required to collect sales tax, probably have a legitimate gripe. But it really has nothing to do with the internet, as you said, and it has more to do with supply chain dynamics than it does with sales tax. I mean, you think about the biggest scourge to Main Street retailers in the United States, it's the fact that they've had to compete with big box stores whose economies of scale and business dynamics and supply chain efficiencies have enabled them to significantly undercut what those Main Street stores were charging.
Which is why you might have seen your neighborhood drugstore close up and get replaced by a CVS.
Think about it. You're right. And the big box stores have been the scourge of Main Street. And it turns out that if you're a Main Street store and you've got something special to sell, maybe it's an item that very few others stock. Perhaps it's something that's a special brand that you have. Well, the internet is not your enemy. The internet is your last best hope to reach customers that would never otherwise darken your doorstep. You need to turn to the internet. So it turns out that the Main Street stores who complain all the time about competition from big box and complain about catalog and online have turned to the internet as their last chance for survival.
And now the big box stores are fighting back, you could say?
Well, the big box stores have learned that in order for them to fight Amazon, their chief competitor,
right,
the big box stores have discovered that they should try to echo chamber the complaints from small Main Street stores. So the Main Street stores are sort of ambivalent when it comes to internet competition. Many of them realize that customers who come into their store did a lot of online research before they came in to buy from their store.
Yeah.
And by the same token, folks wouldn't come into a store, try goods out, and then buy it online for a lower price.
Yeah, people Google best hipster coffee shop near me all the time.
and I think that gets to the point of the lowest price is going to prevail if all you're selling is a commodity item and not a specialty item. But the big box stores have a concerted and rather successful campaign at making this feel as if it's the internet against Main Street, when in fact the big box stores have been the scourge of Main Street. And the internet might be their last best hope to survive.
And we've seen this dynamic with, I had your colleague Carl Szabo on the show to talk about Airbnb, and you see the hotel lobby using the language of, freedom and equality and fairness when that's not what they're pushing for. But for better or worse, these big box retailers, they have a lot of sympathizers. I mean, you look at Congress, and there are otherwise low tax, small government Republicans who are all about increasing online sales tax. And you kind of scratch your head and say, how do they square that equation? But you've also got some questions about the Supreme Court. And you mentioned this Quill decision could potentially go back to the Supreme Court if any of these lawsuits that we've talked about, Alabama, South Dakota, Tennessee, or any other 15 state bills introduced in 2017, it's only March. And we could see this go back to the Supreme Court. And correct me if I'm wrong, Anthony Kennedy, sympathetic to the big box retailers, Neil Gorsuch, Trump's appointee, his nominee, who hasn't been confirmed yet. What should listeners be expecting from the Supreme Court if it goes there because of these two justices or potentially future justices, what they think about this?
Yeah, predicting the way the Supreme Court will decide things is a hazardous profession, not one I'm about to embark into. But so much will depend on the contours of the case that's brought forth. A lot of folks who advocate overturning Quill believe that technology and automation will change everything. But I'd like to remind them to go back and read the 1992 case. Read Justice Stevens's majority opinion, unanimous case.
And oh, that was unanimous. That was a 9-0.
Yeah, and automation was a big factor. Quill was a huge company with mainframe computers. And in the ruling, they suggested that automation is really not the point of it. In fact, it was the idea of exposing every business to the vagaries of then over 10,000 different taxing jurisdictions, 46 different state auditors with different rates and rules and tax thresholds. And that presented a specter that led the Supreme Court to conclusively say, no, you need to have a physical presence before you're going to be subjected to the sales tax regimes of the states where you have customers. Now, how would that change in 2017 or 2018 when, in fact, automation continues to make certain tasks more doable, and yet it would still expose, frankly, every business in the United States to what are now 12,000 different tax jurisdictions, 46 different state auditors with rates and rules and thresholds and tax holidays. So, Evan, I'm not sure that that calculus leads to an override of Quill or an affirmation of Quill. And remember that Quill said two things. It said states can't impose their tax liability on businesses that don't have a physical presence. And then it said, but Congress has the constitutional role and responsibility of dictating the laws governing interstate commerce so that Congress at any time, either before or after the court were to speak to Quill, Congress can step in and its regime sweeps aside whatever it is the Supreme Court has done.
So before we get to Congress, and there's so many bills to discuss, why are people bringing up Neil Gorsuch in relation to internet sales tax? I mean, when we did a podcast about what it means for tech that Trump picked Neil Gorsuch, and a lot of that focused on Fourth Amendment civil liberties issues. And we left internet sales tax out of that podcast because I knew I was going to ask you this question when you came on my podcast. So why are the two connected at all?
Yeah, folks will look into previous opinions that Gorsuch has rendered and try to divine from that research how he would feel about this question. And it's a mixed bag. He's had certain opinions that indicate a rather expansive view of the power of states. And yet, on the other hand, he's been very firm at respecting Supreme Court precedent and the value of stare decisis. And that would suggest that you don't just haphazardly overturn 150 years of doctrine without a really compelling reason to do so. Now, part of that compelling reason has to be based on the role of states and federalism. It can't just be based on, well, the states kind of need the money. In other words, that isn't the way the court sets aside federal doctrine.
That's not how you win an argument at the Supreme
really
Court.
Need
like,
the money.
I need that money
well,
now.
read Justice Kennedy's dissent in the DMA Brawl case, and his opinion was basically the states really need the money. And frankly, how much money is a separate question. But even if it were a lot of money, that isn't exactly the way the court decides on a matter of due process, of minimum contacts, of states reaching beyond their borders in violation of the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. So the notion of how much money is it shouldn't even be part of the argument. But we're always happy to have that discussion because I believe that the states have purposely inflated the amount of money they're thinking about. They based it on an old study long before Amazon decided to expand its empire of fulfillment centers and collect for virtually the entire country. And when you think of it, 24 of the top 25 e-retailers already collect in nearly every state with a sales tax. So who's not collecting? It ends up being a lot of the small businesses. Ironically, it's many of those same Main Street businesses getting clobbered by the big box stores who turn to the internet to find customers and repeat sales to customers that they've pleased before. And ironically, then, the burdens being sought by the big box stores will fall squarely on the small businesses that they've yet to extinguish in the Main Street of America.
Yeah, you've heard some really fantasy numbers put out about how much states are losing out on. You've had states claim that they're losing like $200 million of revenue from one company. And then you'll look at that company. It's not even, they don't even do that many sales total in a year. Like, I don't even know where these numbers are coming from, but just so listeners know, states and localities will obviously for self-interested reasons claim that they're being starved and cheated out of all sorts of money, and really take those issues with a grain of salt and remember what Steve said, which is that that's not a legitimate constitutional argument to say, I need the money. Like, that's not how we do these things. Now, of course, Congress is looking at this issue. And one of the big issues that has gotten a lot of the tax groups riled up, and it's one of your big concerns too, is this taxation without representation. And most of the time when you hear that phrase, it is either a DC license plate or it is in reference to this war that we fought for our independence over that principle. So it's kind of important in the United States. And many of the proposals floating around Congress, and you could even say that if Quill were to get struck down, this would happen by default, creates this issue where states are reaching outside of their borders to tax people who don't have voting power. So you mentioned earlier, you know, Virginia, if they want to tax someone who's in New York trying to buy stuff from a Virginia company, that person in New York can't say, the Virginia sales tax is too high, can I vote out the Virginia governor? They don't have voting power. So why does the issue, how do we get to the issue of taxation without representation? You've got the Marketplace Fairness Act, you've got Remote Transactions Parity Act, which is Congressman Chaffetz from Utah, interestingly, where Overstock is based. How do you end up at a place where people are seriously getting taxed and they don't have the power to vote people out of office?
The taxation without representation argument is an argument against overturning Quill.
Right.
And it's because state sales and use tax laws impose a sales tax on sellers that they can reach and say to their residents of that state, if you didn't pay a sales tax when you bought it, you owe a use tax when you file your next tax return. That's why it's called a sales and use tax. And in those respects, the resident of the state, well, they're being taxed and they have representation and they can vote in their state. But if we were to overturn Quill at the courts or the congressional level, then each state could reach across its borders and force businesses outside of their state to have to pay sales tax to that state when they make sales there. And that's the taxation without representation. It's on the businesses, because virtually every one of the 46 state sales tax statutes impose the sales tax on sellers, whether they collected the money or not. You see, a sales tax is a tax for the privilege of doing business in a state.
Right, and the theory being that the state government provides many services that benefit those brick and mortar stores. They keep you safe. They are there when there's a fire, and there's a reason for that. And that all kind of illustrates my point where, when you're an online retailer and you're not benefiting from any of those state services, you are a creature of the federal government and your state, not all the other 49 states. Now you're getting taxed, and these bills would do that. And what is the response in Congress when people say taxation without representation? Are you serious? We fought a war over this. How are you going to pass a bill that allows a state to reach outside its borders? And another issue that you guys have highlighted is that when there's a lawsuit, so let's say, you know, South Dakota wants to extract taxes from a business in another state for selling to South Dakota residents, and there's a lawsuit over that, it doesn't go to federal court, it goes to South Dakota court. That's called home field advantage. So you've got multiple layers here. And how does something so odious like taxation without representation get all these co-sponsors in Congress, many of them Republicans who claim to hate taxes all the time? How did we get here? Is it just that the brick and mortar retailers have that much influence in government?
I would say that big box stores have phenomenal influence in government, and they've been quite effective at getting property tax and sales tax relief of their own when they set up stores. So their influence is significant in both Republican and democratically controlled districts. But in addition, the U.S. Senate is full of individuals that many of whom used to be governors, and governors who grappled with sales tax collection issues in their home state are quite sympathetic to the notion that, well, the states really need more money. And that tends to drive a desperate reach for anything that will increase revenues. But the burdens that you've suggested, as well as the taxation without representation, those are well acknowledged, even by the advocates of new internet sales tax. They acknowledged it as much as a decade and a half ago when they encouraged the states to set up a simplification project to try to streamline and simplify their sales tax systems, to make those burdens less significant, although not zero. That was the Streamlined Sales Tax Project, and I've been part of that for 13 years, representing the business community. And at this point, that's really become an illusion. Long ago, the states abandon any promises to come up with, say, one rate per state, a single audit that would be respected with reciprocity, a single set of definitions so that a candy bar and a granola bar would have the same definition in every state. They were unable to accomplish even the most basic amount of simplification. They couldn't even get the state of Maryland to agree on a rounding rule when you compute sales tax. We all learn rounding rules in kindergarten, and yet Maryland has a completely different rounding rule and is not going to change it because they believe it brings in an extra $40 million a year of taxes. And the states have abandoned this idea of truly simplifying in a way that they could please Congress. And that led them to say that, simple or not, we need to lobby Congress. When we'll use rhetoric about the states need the money, we'll use rhetoric about fairness, and we'll try to get Congress to extend the reach of state tax collectors beyond their borders. And as you know, there are two pieces of legislation, one of which in 2013 got 69 votes in the U.S. Senate, the Marketplace Fairness Act. And any bill that has fairness in the title should be a warning to you to reach for your wallet.
Yeah. Oh, you mean like the USA Patriot Act, which was super patriotic.
That's exactly right. So I got 69 votes in the U.S. Senate, and that's saying something, since you can't get 69 votes in the U.S. Senate for a Mother's Day resolution.
Or, yeah, what day is it today? Yeah.
So fortunately, though, it traveled to the House of Representatives, and the able mind of Chairman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, holding the gavel on the House Judiciary Committee, said, well, hang on a minute. He's very concerned about state revenue. He's very concerned about the fairness argument. But he said, MFA is not the way.
Yeah.
We are not going to solve that problem by creating a whole new raft of problems that you, Evan, have talked about today. The overreach of state tax controllers beyond their borders, taxation without representation, the audit risks that would squash the last best hope of many small businesses to reach customers around the country.
Yeah, it's just practically speaking, I mean, we've talked about how this impacts, you know, in macro terms, but if you're a online retailer and MFA gets passed and it takes effect, what is the practical impact on your business and then on your customers?
A lot of that depends on which version of MFA it is. Jason Chaffetz, Representative Chaffetz in the House of Representatives, has a variety on MFA.
Yeah, RTPA.
And, right, exactly. Remote Transaction Parity Act. Ironically, he calls it transaction parity. I guess the only transaction parity for him, ironically, would be that we would force every store, when it makes a sale at the counter, at the cash register, to ask the customer for his ID so we could figure out what the tax rate was where that customer lives and quickly remit that tax to where the customer lives, regardless of whatever state they're from. That would be parity for what Jason Chaffetz and MFA have in mind.
So you're creating police, like basically the stores are now policemen. They have to figure out where everyone lives, make sure that when the Virginia resident comes into West Virginia and buys something, I've got to find out what Virginia charges, and I've got to somehow get this money to the Virginia government. And that's all on the business.
That's right.
To make that happen.
And Evan, that would be parity. And we're being slightly sarcastic here. That would be parity. But that's not the way that Representative Chaffetz does parity. Instead, he makes only the online and catalog sellers collect and remit where every single customer lives. But he lets every store continue to collect and remit only based on where the store is located. And Chairman Goodlatte saw the ridiculous notion of that kind of parity. So Goodlatte said, if we're going to sweep aside Quill, we are going to do it only in a way that makes a business answerable to the tax collectors in his own state. We are not going to allow tax collectors and auditors to reach across their borders to businesses with no physical presence. And that was Goodlatte's approach from the beginning when he put a stop to MFA in the House of Representatives. A year or two later, Goodlatte finally came up with a bill of his own, the Online Sales Simplification Act, which codifies the fact that a state may not reach beyond its borders to businesses without a physical presence, but goes on to say that the states, if they wish, can form a multi-state compact by which each state can tax all sales made by businesses in its state. And when that revenue, that tax revenue, comes from an out-of-state resident, the states will divvy the revenue up once a month through a tax clearinghouse.
And this is a state burden, not a business burden. And that's one of the major sticking points here, right? And that's why, is that your preference here?
There is really no burden. Actually, what you may not know is for the past three decades, the fuel tax on trucks, interstate trucks, is conducted in exactly the same way. Uh-huh. It's the the international fuel tax arrangement. It includes Canada and Mexico and all the states in the United States. And Chairman Goodlatte modeled his bill on that. It's a system by which the home state of a trucker collects all the tax, along with reports indicating where that truck was driven. And then once a month, when the truckers file their fuel taxes, the states have a clearinghouse that divvies up the money based on where the miles are driven. And it's been working fine. I think it takes three or four people to run the clearinghouse, and it might take another three or four to run this clearinghouse for sales tax. So that quote-unquote burden of distributing the money is not a burden of any significance.
It's something they do with other types of taxes, right? So is this the preferred solution from your perspective? Your organization, Net Choice, represents e-commerce, and clearly there were some serious concerns about Marketplace Fairness Act and Chaffetz's version of that, discriminating against online retailers, creating massive burdens, 10,000 tax codes, 45 states. If you sell even a dollar worth of stuff, you're getting roped into things on if you do that online. I mean, does the Goodlatte approach avoid all that and create the actual fairness that the brick and mortar retailers have been claiming they want?
Yeah, the four bills in Congress are diametrically opposed. The MFA and the Chaffetz bill start from the standpoint of giving brand new, unprecedented powers to tax collectors, but finding ways to make it feel a little less awful.
Like the small business exemption that Chaffetz...
The disappearing small business exception, which vanishes in 3 years and never shows up at all if you made so much as a dollar of sales on a marketplace.
Right, like eBay or...
Right, and the illusory protections against audits, which suggests that if you use one of the state-sponsored, state-subsidized certified solution providers, you can't be held responsible for errors they made.
Oh, that's not a cronyist problem at all.
Oh, but you can be held responsible for every error you made. And it turns out that as a retailer, where you're going to make your errors is in misclassifying the things that you sell. Pennsylvania doesn't tax the American flag, and a retailer in Pennsylvania made it all the way to a state audit court and was assessed over $25,000 because he didn't realize that that only covered the current U.S. flag. It didn't cover previous historical U.S. flags.
So 49 stars on the flag, and I'm getting to that is
the
ridiculous.
The Betsy Ross flag, don't tread on me. He had been classifying all those as U.S.
flags. Clearly
he
should have known this. I mean, it's totally reasonable to expect businesses to just divine the difference in what type of flag gets taxed.
And when he asked, where is that in the tax code? The state's answer was, well, it's not in the code. It was in a ruling. So look, this is an example and it's a story, but it's examples and stories that enrich our debate on topics like this. And this is only one of many stories. There are 12,000 tax jurisdictions, 46 different states with their own rates and rules. And those rules themselves would have to be known in detail for even the tiniest retailer as he took his 1,100 items of inventory and classified them as to whether they're taxable or not, whether they're subject to thresholds and caps, like the first $110 of food and clothing and shoes in New York City aren't subject to New York City sales tax, but the $111 is. So they have to classify and categorize it for every single one of the jurisdictions they sell to. And a single error in that classification that results in them collecting the wrong amount of tax exposes them to those audit risks, taxes, and penalties. Now, Chaffetz does nothing to protect businesses from those very risks that we talked about. So Goodlatte and former chairman Jim Sensenbrenner are on the other side of the spectrum. They start from the premise that says, hang on, Congress has the role in interstate commerce. Constitution set that up 225 years ago. The Quill ruling is 150 years of jurisprudence suggesting that states cannot tax businesses without a physical presence. So the first thing Congress does in the Goodlatte and Sensenbrenner bill is lock down that law from Quill. It says that states cannot reach beyond their borders. They can only tax businesses with a physical presence.
And would that moot any of the ongoing court cases over Quill? If Congress were to reaffirm Quill in a law that gets signed by President Trump, that would be it, right? There are no more court challenges over Quill.
Evan, that's exactly right. And that's the beauty of that approach. And I do think that there is some hazard to betting that the court will go one way or the other on the next litigation of Quill. My organization, NetChoice, joined the American Catalog Mailers in suing the state of South Dakota in May of 2016 when they took a direct frontal challenge to Quill. Just this week, we are suing the state of Tennessee over a similar regulatory ruling there. And we're currently considering whether Wyoming deserves the same treatment in a lawsuit. The good news that's just in is that South Dakota's circuit court yesterday ruled in favor of our side and said that the state's law, which would have flouted the Quill ruling, the state's law was unconstitutional and granted summary judgment to our side, forcing the state to decide to appeal to the state Supreme Court.
Well, congratulations on the victory.
It's one of many steps, but that victory may not lead to ultimate victory.
Right.
As you said prior to that setup, the ultimate victory is that Congress should exercise the role the Constitution created for them, and Congress should speak clearly as to what the powers are for a state to reach beyond its borders.
And you might be thinking, you know, if you're a free market person, a small government person, a federalism guy, and you like states' rights, you might be thinking, hang on, you know, why is Congress coming in here and telling states what they can do? On the other hand, Congress telling a state that you're not allowed to reach outside into another state, that could be seen as protecting states' rights. And exactly. When we're dealing with the internet and interstate commerce, that is the federal role. So, you know, like I can understand why people might say, I want my state to be able to hose these retailers. They're getting cheated. But we're talking about a borderless internet, and we're talking about taxation without representation. And if Congress wants to protect those principles, that seems like an appropriate role for the federal government.
And the Constitution gave that role uniquely to Congress and not to the states. By dodging their role, Congress only leaves it in this limbo where we live today. This notion that court cases could end up making it swing either way, that court cases have to go to state court first. I spoke about our South Dakota success yesterday, but we had to litigate that in state court. We weren't allowed to go to federal court because a federal law called the Tax Injunction Act forces us, if we're going to take on a state, to go into that state's home courts in front of that state's home judges and still prevail, as we did yesterday. So that really puts the burden on a business to have to hire lawyers in the state of the courts where they're challenging, and then spend all that extra money on trying to litigate there. I'd love to see that changed so that a challenge to federal law regarding interstate commerce could be brought in federal courts.
There's a longstanding acceptance in this country that no one likes a tattletale and snitches get stitches. And that brings us to another issue in this debate, which is that, you know, the retailers who want these bad bills in Congress, they've lashed out in many ways, which whether it's proposing those bills, lobbying for them, suing, yada, yada. There's other things they've been doing, though. And what's this tattletale issue? So a couple of states, Colorado and Louisiana, I keep hearing that they're basically saying that retailers need to tattletale on their customer when they're not living in that state. I mean, what is going on here?
Yeah, this is an ingenious and devious scheme that was hatched by some large retailers.
You have to admire the deviousness of it.
You really have to admire the cleverness. And it first was passed in 2010 in the state of Colorado. Since 2010, it's been tied up in courts. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, who decided not to take the case. But it really doesn't involve Quill, as it turns out. It's a tattletale reporting regime where Colorado requires that every retailer making a sale to a Colorado resident has to either collect and remit the sales tax, Colorado, or they can do reporting. And the reporting regime means let the customer know that they're going to probably owe use tax on this item. At the end of the year, send the customer a report on what they purchased to make it easy for them to pay their use tax. Oh, and in February of the following year, send the state of Colorado a report listing every single customer in Colorado who made purchases from you and indicate that customer's address and the shipping address and the amount of purchases that they made. And that is what we mean by tattletale reporting.
And that's all going to go in a government database. The government now knows what I bought, where I live, where it got shipped to, all these things.
They'll know the total amount of purchases. And in the case of having things that were shipped to a certain location, they'll know that shipping address as well. Now, ostensibly, you would think the state would then use that information then to send use tax notices to the residents of Colorado. But there was never any intention for the state to do that. That would be a highly unpopular thing for the Colorado Tax Department and Colorado government to do.
Yeah, those voters can actually vote you out because they live in Colorado.
Yes, and reminding those voters that yet again, you want to move more money from their pockets to the state capital in Denver is no way to get reelected. So instead, the devious part of this law was that the privacy surprise, the privacy shock to your customers is such that businesses would not report. They would not tattletale on purchases to the state. They'll, of course, they'll just knuckle down and they'll collect the tax, without any simplification, without any compensation, without a change to Quill, they would elect to collect rather than tattletale. And this was the calculus that led to the Colorado law being passed. Now, here we are 6-7 years later. The law is still not in effect yet. It should take effect by July of 2017. But a growing chorus of businesses have said, hell no, we are not going to knuckle under and collect an unfair, unconstitutional tax. Instead, we're going to report. And we're going to force you, the state of Colorado, to do what you never wanted to do, which was to chase your own citizens to remit more taxes to the state of Colorado. And I think that could be the undoing of this law. And the House Majority Leader in Colorado has just recently introduced a repeal measure so that the tattletale aspects of their law would not even take effect at all.
Yeah, and that's a massive privacy concern. That's a cybersecurity concern. We've seen state agencies, federal agencies not be very good stewards of citizens' data. And it's one thing when, you know, a company that you signed a contract with screws up and gets breached. You know, there's maybe some mechanisms there. There's some accountability there. But guess what happens when the government gets breached and your data gets taken by hackers? Nothing. Nothing happens. 25 million federal employees had their data hacked at the Office of Personnel Management, the federal government. Nothing happened. No, there's no accountability there. We're not shutting down OPM. Maybe someone resigned. Maybe they had a fall guy. But really, there's a lack of accountability here. And I know that there's a lot of groups who might not otherwise care about internet sales tax who will look at the privacy issue and say, whoa, I'm not getting into a tax debate, but you should not be maintaining databases of people based on where they live and what they purchase. That's insane.
I agree, Evan. And there's nothing in the Colorado law that adds special cybersecurity protections to the data. There's nothing preventing other state agencies from getting at that data if they wish to make some public relations problems.
I could FOIA that, another, right? Freedom of Information Act. I could just say I want data. Like I can now get my fellow citizen stuff or...
Could be. And if it's possible that, that's another part of the law that needs to be clarified. But it would be better still to simply repeal yeah. the tattletale portion of the law. And to really put a finer point on the privacy problem, when you're reporting the total amount of purchases, it still tells the state an awful lot about your personal issues. If the vendor who reported on you was a vendor who handles, let's say, specialty medical products that might reveal the kind of medical conditions you might have, maybe movies, books, or other entertainment products that would reveal maybe your sexual preferences. It could reveal that if you're buying books from a bankruptcy consulting firm that you're having financial problems. And when it comes to medical, financial, and personal products, you're also going to add the notion that the state of Colorado would learn that if I'm buying jewelry and have it shipped to a different address, because shipping address, different than billing address, has to be reported to the state. So the privacy problems are there, even though Colorado thought they had dodged them by asking only for the total amount of purchases. The truth is, if I know the vendors you're buying from and where your things are being shipped, that is a privacy concern that should generate some issues with all Americans, especially because other states are seeking to copy it. We have three bills this year, one in Rhode Island, one in Utah, one in Nebraska, that substantially replicate the Colorado approach in the hopes that it will force businesses to collect rather than tattletale on their customers. So we're looking for support in Colorado for the repeal measure. And if that doesn't work, we'll continue to look at the courts as a remedy.
So bottom line, we've laid out so many moving parts. There's court cases, there's state bills getting proposed every day, there's local stuff, there's whether or not Supreme Court takes the case. I mean, I'm going to ask you to try to predict what the hell's going to happen. I don't expect you to be able to give a concrete answer, but as listeners, you know, maybe they got interested in this issue now because they've heard such an articulate person explain it to them. And what should they be looking out for, whether it's in their own state or the federal government? What's going to happen over the next year as this issue really starts to heat up?
Yeah, the state strategy of generating nuisance nexus bills, tattletale reporting, and kill Quill challenges, that strategy's working. It's creating a whack-a-mole situation where tax advocates like your organization and mine and businesses are becoming completely frustrated and overwhelmed with the state efforts. And that's leading them to ask Congress to solve this problem.
Yeah, to create actual fairness, maybe, and some certainty. Because if you're a small business, having this issue hang over your head is not helpful. And we mentioned earlier, look, you're a mom-and-pop blog. You've got a deal with Overstock or Amazon that they have ads on your website and they click through to certain products, you could end up losing that revenue based on what happens here, or Amazon or Overstock could just say, look, we're going to pull the ads because the fact that we have an ad on your website means we have a physical presence in your state. Yeah. I mean, it gets insane. The affiliates, right? Quote unquote affiliates. An affiliate could be some food blogger.
That's exactly right. And there are 19 states that copied that New York affiliate law. And in all 19 states, Amazon, Overstock, and the companies paying commissions canceled their commission programs.
Which hurts the small people. That doesn't hurt those businesses.
For the state that passes it, it's all pain and no gain.
Right.
Only their in-state businesses lost revenue, and there were small businesses, and there was no gain in sales tax collection whatsoever. So those kind of all pain, no gain are still contributing to the nuisance nexus strategy of the states. And I'm afraid to admit it, but that strategy is working. And it's raised the chorus of demand among American businesses to say that Congress needs to step in. So what to watch for, Evan, is watch for whether Congress starts from the side of MFA, Marketplace Fairness and Chaffetz, which says that we're starting from the premise that tax collectors of every state should be given powers to reach any business in the country. Or do they start on the other end of the extreme, the Goodlatte-Sensenbrenner side, which affirms the physical presence rule of Quill, constitutionally based, and then goes on to create some mechanism by which states, if they wish, can exact taxes on businesses in their own state and find a way to divide that revenue up among the states where the consumers live.
So listeners, if you're looking to dig into this issue a little bit more, we've got a blog post from NetChoice that really summarizes this in a really good way. You've got Quill, you've got the Marketplace Fairness Act, you've got the Remote Transactions Parity Act. Those two are on the anti-Quill side. Then on the pro-Quill side, you've got Sensenbrenner's No Regulation Without Representation Act, which is pretty aptly named. And then you've got Representative Goodlatte's bill, Online Sales Simplification Act, known as OSA in the tax policy world. Steve, any parting thoughts?
Yeah, remember this, though. The total amount of so-called uncollected sales tax on catalog and online.
Yes, this is the money that the people are missing out on. This is why we're having this debate, Steve. How much money are they missing out on?
This is amazing. But using the U.S. Census Bureau, who does quarterly reporting on total e-commerce, using their data, the most this could be is about 0.5% of total state and local tax revenue. That is less than 0.5% of state and local tax revenue. And what little revenue that is actually not coming from the pockets of out-of-state businesses. It comes from the pockets of your state's own citizens and voters. And all you're doing is enlisting the catalogs and online companies to vacuum it from your pocket and bring it to the state capital. So it's never bringing a penny of new money into a state. It's just moving the money from citizens to government. And how much are we talking about? Less than 0.5% of state and local tax revenue. Let's not let this battle, which is really between the big box stores and Amazon, let's not let that battle cause casualties among the small business of America who turn to the internet more and more and more to reach customers around the country and around the world.
I like that notion in general, that the average citizen should not be the victim of a corporate squabble. That's not what we're trying to do here. Well, for more information, check out netchoice.org. They're really plugged in on this stuff. And my guest has been Steve DelBianco, Executive Director of NetChoice, which is a trade association of e-commerce businesses and online consumers. Steve, thank you for walking us through this complicated yet vital issue.
Evan, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for all you do.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.